Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
Hello, this is John Romeri, your host, and you're listening to Music from the Tower. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the beautiful campus of Christ Cathedral. Today's guest is Father Virgil Funk. Father is just a normal parish priest from the Diocese of Richmond. Wrong. Father is probably one of the most influential people in all of Catholic Church music. He is the founder of and the first president of the National Association of Pastoral Musicians. And we're going to find out just what that association is, why Father started it, what brought Father to that decision to open that out. So welcome, Virgil.
Well, thank you very much, John. I'm happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here in Garden Grove. It's just great.
Yeah, it's a great place. I remember at the National Catholic Reporter when I was retiring, which happened in 2001, the interviewer, Alan Jones, said, the church musicians know who he is, but the rest of the world doesn't. But every church musician knows what his name is. So my reputation is just probably not your listening audience, unless they happen to be church musicians.
Well, that's why I thought we better introduce who this Father Virgil Funk is. Well, Father, you're a priest of the Diocese of Richmond.
I was ordained in 1963, so that puts me over 55 years in as a Roman Catholic priest. I was a pastor in Richmond, and in 1974, I was very much interested in the liturgy. But it felt like the parish was not engaging in the renewal of the church that I expected. And I came to find out, I went to the national level to try and discover what how to improve the liturgy. Because my heart was connected with, and I was in love with the liturgy.
Well, as a liturgist, though, what brought you to create an association for musicians?
Well, after I went to the national level, I spent 2 years as the director of the liturgical conference. So I got in touch with all the best liturgists following the Second Vatican Council. And I realized that there was a whole group of people who were serving the church on a very significant level, but no one was paying attention to them. And that was the church musician. And it wasn't just the cathedral musician. It wasn't the person who was at the big parishes. It was the little guy. They were out in rural parishes. And the amazing thing about them is that they had this incredible love and dedication to the church. But no one was assisting in their ministry, in their formation, particularly in their liturgical formation, of how to take the new repertoire and insert it appropriately into the liturgy.
This, in my estimation, is really what makes NPM different from most other associations. If you look at the Roman Catholic cathedral musicians, those are just specifically for very highly trained cathedral musicians. The Anglican Musician Association started with their top cream of the crop. You had to have letters of recommendation to get in. And NPM was absolutely the opposite. You could be a cantor who didn't even read music and a member somehow of this association.
Not only a cantor, John, but also the clergy. One of the key ideas that we had at the very beginning, and we defined ourselves as clergy and musicians, a membership organization of clergy and musician dedicated to fostering the art of musical liturgy. Each one of those words is important. The clergy had a significant role in the formation of a parish church musician dedicated to fostering the art. It wasn't something that we were trying to impose on a church musician. We were trying to develop the beauty and the richness of the liturgy.
It and, was, Many of these church musicians, of course, had done it for years, 20 years maybe, and yet without the background, without the training, they were just well-meaning volunteers or underpaid, but yet no one, you were quite right, was really caring for them. Some of them had made it through the transition, for example. They knew chant, they knew the Liber, they knew St. Gregory's hymnal, but no one had taken them in and showed them the beauty of the new liturgy.
So in 1976, I've sent a mailing out to a group of my friends and said, would it be possible for a non-musician to organize the musicians, even though I was the chanter and the head singer in the choir in the seminary. I was in the seminary for 12 years, so I had a lot of experience with chant. I had a lot of experience with the contemporary repertoire, but I wasn't, technically speaking, trained in music. I have a doctorate in liturgy. I was trained with Ray Brown in sacred scripture, and I have a master's degree in social work in community organizing. And I think the master's degree in social work was the most important part in working with church musicians.
Well, did you find out that you absolutely cannot organize church musicians?
Well, it's like
there's no possibility.
It's called herding cats, John. It's herding cats. But these people, the church musicians love the church. They love what they do. They are totally committed to it. So, and I'm in love with the liturgy. So I wanted to share some of my consciousness about the liturgical renewal with the musicians, and particularly the mystery of Jesus. That central to the liturgy isn't the ritual exterior elements. A lot of people who got involved in the liturgical reform were interested in the vestments or the decorations or the exterior. I was interested in what was the central symbols, what was the mystery of our faith being presented.
Well, can you see that this was the perfect man to somehow create this organization? So in 1976, you had your first gathering in Scranton.
No, 1978. We formed the organization in 76, and a priest, Father James Bannick in Scranton, said, we've got to do a convention. And I said, I couldn't do a convention. I'm overwhelmed. It's not possible. He says, you get the speakers, and I'll do the organizing.
There you go.
We plan to have 600 people come to our first meeting, and 1,700 people showed up. As a result, we had people in Wilkesboro. They were driving 45 minutes to come to the first convention.
I was not present, but I heard the chaos.
Yeah,
I was the director of music for the Diocese of Pittsburgh at that time, and I heard the chaos, how exciting everybody was thrilled.
Well, we had to double all the sessions. You know, the room wasn't big enough, and so the main session we had twice, and we had the St. Louis Jesuits were there, but we also had Richard Prue from the Chicago
Cathedral,
some really, really fine musicians. Because the principle I had was that the better musician, these high-qualified musicians, not unlike yourself, have a responsibility to reach out to the other less fortunate, less trained musicians to assist them in their ministry, simply because the ministry of the church musician is not an easy ministry. It looks simple, but it in fact is, it requires a skill in liturgy. It requires a skill in music. It requires a skill in communication.
Social work.
Yeah, no, exactly. And not only a skill, but it also, to go with that skill, that's something you do, in other words, you also had to have a knowledge of the field of music, a knowledge of the field of liturgy, a knowledge of the field of how you interacted with your pastor. And you had to have a set of values. What was important? What wasn't important? So you've got these nine levels of not just doing it, but knowing what the values were, as well as being able to do it, practically speaking.
Well, and I think that's the challenge for all musicians. You're usually working alone in a parish. And what gives you that? Where does that strength come from? Sometimes it comes from the example of a cathedral musician. Sometimes it comes from an association like National Pastoral Musicians.
It's this, John. People in love make signs of love. The liturgy is a sign of love. Good music enhances our faith. Bad music destroys our faith, unfortunately. So I had this realization that when you have a really bad experience of music in worship, you'll come back a second time, maybe, but not the third time and not the fourth time. You keep feeding bad music to the ritual, and it will destroy the meaning of the ritual for the average lay person in the pew. And so it was a question of the challenge to love the sound of a singing congregation above all other sounds.
Well, and on that note, let's listen to a little singing. We're going to listen to a piece recorded by an NPM convention choir conducted by our own Southern California Paul Solomonovich. And this is a little cut called We Gather Together. We'll be right back. With Music from the Tower, here from the Tower of Hope on the wonderful campus of Christ Cathedral. Today's guest is the most interesting, Father Virgil Funk. We have talked in the first segment about his own desire, his creation of the National Association of Pastoral Musicians. This is 7,000 people strong all over the country, everything from the top cathedral musicians in the country to the lowliest cantor, to the beginning guitar, choir members, all of the above. We talked about the formation of the association. Let's talk about its goals, your dream for where this was going to go.
Well, what happened was that after we had the convention in Scranton with 600 people planned and 1,700 people arriving, Dolly Sokol came to me from Chicago and said, we've got to do this convention in Chicago. Well, Chicago's a big city. She invited the convention to Chicago. We still didn't have staff, so we were looking for how the staff would develop the convention. And those people here in Los Angeles who know about the L.A. Religious Ed Congress.
Oh, my gosh, the largest conference in the world.
Exactly. Well, we were happening at the same time. We began the same time, actually a little bit earlier, and some of the ideas that are in the L.A. Religious Congress came from the National Association of Pastoral Musicians Conference. But the next year, after we did Chicago with 3,000 members, we then did 12 regional conventions with a staff of three people.
Oh, my God.
So we were running around the country organizing these meetings. And what happened was that there was this tremendous outflow from the church musicians because they knew they needed this type of an organization. And the primary push that was driving them in 1980 was lack of quality repertoire in the vernacular. The association ended up being a fertilizing system in the United States. This was before the publishers got involved in publishing their music, in cross-feeding the country. Now, John, you and I both know some of that music was way better than others, but it was a question of we didn't know where it was all going to go in 1980. It was a risk. So I wasn't interested in the repertoire. I, as a person of this association, I was interested in not the music, but the musician. I was interested in what is the musician getting paid? How is the musician getting trained? What's the spiritual formation for the church musician? You're as good a lover as you are a sign maker. If you can't make good signs of love, your love will indeed fail. So what happened was that some of the church musicians started failing precisely because they were having their own ego involved in it. They were trying to develop themselves as a repertoire. A repertoire developer. They got in love with their own music. A sign is where you express yourself, and music is a form of self-expression. What was so important to the church musician at this time was a recognition that the music that is celebrated in the liturgy is its own unique art form, and it has a history of its own unique art form. In fact, it's longer than recording music, than secular music. Church music in the liturgy goes way back.
But is this what you found, at least for me as a musician, this is what I found difficult, because I found people at the NPM only interested in the latest, greatest piece. And they had somehow forgotten 600 years of church music and only did what was, you know, the latest from the publisher showcase. And their parishes were being fed only the latest, greatest new until they could get to the next convention to find the next latest, greatest new. How did the association balance that between the church's rich musical history and, you know, showcasing the newest music?
I made the decision that I wasn't the gatekeeper in repertoire. And that was a very, very risky decision.
Yeah, because did that leave the publishers as the gatekeepers?
I said it was the bishops who were responsible for being the gatekeeper.
Well, let me tell you, that didn't work.
Everybody looks to the National Association as if it were the repertoire gatekeeper. And everything you've heard is that this association was dedicated not to music, but to musicians. It was dedicated to trying to develop the skills, the understanding, the judgment making, the decision making of the church musician at the parish level. And that's quite a different question than what's the latest and greatest in terms of repertoire. The answer to your question is yes. Did the latest repertoire seduce the members of the association? And did repertoire sessions developed by the publishers become the energizing element of the church?
Sure, because something to take home and do next week.
Yeah, but it was also a lively musicians. Unfortunately, love repertoire.
Right.
That's who they think they are, is how do I see myself in the repertoire that I perform?
Coming home from the convention and having the latest, greatest piece over the neighbor who maybe didn't go to the convention.
Not only that, and they could hardly wait to impose it
on their congregations. Right. Yeah,
so
exactly.
All of this was something that I was fully aware of, but had no ability in my own mind to be that gatekeeper, because the process of where the repertoire in the vernacular was going to go was going to be by the musical ear of the assembly, the cultural musical ear of the assembly. Because if you were doing participatory music, then the cultural ear of the assembly singing it will be the gatekeeper of whether or not that music does or does not get sung.
Exactly.
Because if they don't like it, guess what they're going to do?
Yeah.
They ain't
going to
sing it.
Right, exactly.
So it was self-corrective, But it was a longer process than
any
just
of
simply
us wanted it to be.
And it would have been so much easier if Virgil or John would have made the decisions for the entire for the entire United States and assume responsibility for every parish. But of course, you can't, John.
Right.
Nor could I, because you could make a decision for Christ Cathedral, but you couldn't make the decision for little parish in New Jersey, because that parish in New Jersey is affected by the culture of that parish.
So in some ways, it's like when a musician finally gets to graduate study and you go to musicology course. And now you're listening to six recordings of a Beethoven symphony. And the teacher said, okay, which one's better?
Exactly.
Well, they all sounded the same.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were all the same notes, but they were interpreted in many ways. What makes you think that this one's better, the teacher would say? Well, what you have to impose upon that judgment of I like this and I like that is the musicianship and the musical knowledge that you have in your warehouse. And so being able to take that knowledge and do it liturgically to say, this is a good piece of music, or this is a good piece of liturgical music, or this is a good piece that will serve my congregation. All of those things is what I think NPM helped the musicians who came make that pastoral judgment.
Well, this is where the bishops did come in. They published a document in 1972. Again, they revised it in 1984. It was about the threefold judgment, a pastoral judgment, a liturgical judgment, and a musical judgment. And the bishops didn't know how to make the musical judgment. The theologians did know how to make the liturgical judgment. But only the musician in the parish, and I'm saying the musician and the clergyman in that parish, knew how to make the pastoral judgment for the context of that local community. And so it's a far more complicated question than just arbitrarily from on high waving a stick and saying, I'm going to fix all this with one swoop of my magic wand.
And when we come back, we're going to find out a lot more. Even we're going to find out what the Pope says about fixing this with a magic wand in a conference that both Father Funk and I attended recently in Rome. So we'll be right back. And as we play off this segment, we're going to listen to another cut from Paul Solomonovich, Were You There? And we are back with Music from the Tower and our guest, Father Virgil Funk. When we left off the last segment, we just began to talk about church documents, music and Catholic worship, and then later on, music and liturgical music today. Of course, that was followed up by Sing to the Lord later on. So there are many church documents, but one is Musica Sacra. We just celebrated in Rome the 50th anniversary of Musica Sacra. I was at this conference in Rome, and so was Father Funk. And so let's talk a little bit about what the musician feels, what the pastor, how pastoral musicians and PM affected this. But let's talk about this conference just a bit and what the Pope had to say about this whole thing.
It was a wonderful, moving experience for me personally. To greet him, yeah. But John and I both greeted him personally, and I had seen Paul the VI before. You had opportunity to see
several
previous
times with other popes, John Paul.
So, but there's something very special about Francis's presence for me. When he was present to the receiving line.
Well, and he greeted all 350 of us, and he was absolutely present to each person.
Yeah, it was just amazing.
There was no sense of, I'm just shaking your hand.
There was that funny moment while we were waiting. We got into the Clementine Hall, which is a papal palace. It wasn't the big room that tourists normally have an audience
right,
with
we
the
had
Pope.
A very
this
private
was
a, audience.
And we had to climb up three flights of stairs into the Clementine room. Some of our musicians had a little trouble getting up the stairs.
Huffing and puffing.
We won't talk about that. But while we were sitting there waiting, I don't know if you remember, John, when one of the cardinal archbishops, the room silenced, and he walked by, and he turned and realized that he was cutting through the papal palace, and he came into this room that we were all there, and he looked at the audience, and he says, I'm not he.
We do that.
And he went on. It was really a pretty funny moment.
The whole place went hushed.
Hush, yeah, exactly.
It was great. But that was a wonderful moment. The Pope was actually the final speaker of the four or five-day conference. We heard from people really from all over the world. Different liturgists, different musicians from everywhere, from Notre Dame to India to Israel. And it was quite a conference. And talking about sort of what Musica Sacra and the Second Vatican Council unleashed. Until that time, we sang in Latin. So that meant that the music had a certain genre. Well, with the introduction of the vernacular, that introduced all sorts of things musically into our literature. Now we have music that takes on the music of the culture. Here at Christ Cathedral, we have many cultures, 12 masses a week and in four languages.
It's amazing.
With that comes the music of four cultures.
I recommend to everybody listening to this to make a visit to Christ Cathedral.
It is amazing.
You can't believe it until you see it. The plurality of the cultures all on this one 34-acre campus. It's amazing.
It is amazing, and it's such an honor to be the music director of such a place. Just recently, I conducted a concert with our choirs, and there I am. We're having the Spanish choir and the cathedral choir sing Misa Criolla, a wonderful Spanish mass. And at the same concert, the Spanish choir and the cathedral choir are singing the Palestrina Sicut Servos. Now, that's at the cathedral level, and how lucky we are. We have a man, Dr. Ricardo Soto, with a doctorate in music, conducting our Spanish choir. So you can imagine what a great level at which they achieve. But that's not the case everywhere. But now we've got popular music entering because now you can sing in your own language. So this conference dealt a little bit with that.
Some of that. The way the meeting actually took place, John, for our listening audience, Cardinal Ravese, who is for the Council of Culture, gave a presentation after the Holy Father had arrived, and sitting alongside him was Cardinal Versaldi, who is the Council for Education. So Education and Culture were the two sponsoring groups. And here's a little summary of what the Holy Father had to say, and I think it's worth noting.
Yes, let's quote that.
Francis spoke first of three aspects of church music, the repertoire that we've been talking about in the previous two segments, the theology, what's the meaning of the rite and the meaning of music in the rite, and the need for education. And what he said as to repertoire was that musicians now have a twofold mission of maintaining the rich heritage from the past without a nostalgic vision that we're creating something from archaeology, but also a mission of developing music enculturated into today's world. So this issue that's been on the table since the Second Vatican Council of the classical repertoire and the enculturated repertoire, the Pope has now at this conference said every musician has a twofold mission. And so you can't just go one way on this question. You can, but the Holy Father...
The
Holy Fathers encourage us to do high-quality performance music as well as participatory music, the song of the assembly. And he went on to talk about, in his theology point, participation, which is a hot-button topic. And the central emphasis of the participant who's listening to this radio program would be participating in the liturgy through music. Now, some people believe that you achieve participation only or simply by singing. And the Holy Father added a nuance to that that I think is absolutely important. The central emphasis on the notion of participating is that we are, first of all, participating in the mystery of God.
So that's very different than I've got to sing every song at this liturgy.
Correct. The central emphasis, it's not just by participating in singing only. Now, if you go back to the first segment that we talked about, it was this struck me at such a high level because it was exactly what drew me, my love for the liturgy and my awareness that there was something richer and more profound in the liturgy that was taking place, namely the death and resurrection of the Lord represented as a covenant, this unbelievable reality. It's not just the presence of Jesus, which is important, but even more important is it's the act of Jesus offering himself to the Father, which we, as members of the assembly, participate in. That's the theophany that the Holy Father was talking about, and it takes place in every Eucharist, and that's what we're called to participate in.
Not singing three hymns at Mass every week?
Exactly. So what was also music to my ear was the third leg of the Pope's presentation, not only repertoire, the twofold aspect of the repertoire, not only the notion of participation as participating in the mystery of the reality of the Trinity, but what was music to my ears was Francis's call for education of musicians. Why was that music to my ears? Because I spent 25 years of my life dedicated to fostering the art of musical liturgy among musicians. Educating of musicians was at the central part of who I am and what my vocation was. And so the Holy Father was saying, we have to provide education to, and he named them, musicians, composers, choir members, conductors, and especially clergy.
Ding, so, ding, 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 ding,
ding, ding, ding, ding, ding. So the musical formation of the clergy is critical, says Pope Francis, to the development of the ritual and the liturgy and the divine worship of our times. So for an association of musicians and clergy dedicated to fostering the art of musical liturgy, this message of the Holy Father was a message for the National Association of Pastoral Musicians.
It sounds like reconfirming the syllabus of the entire association, doesn't it?
You hear it. And I was just so delighted. We were also, after the event took place, John and I had an opportunity to gather and talk with other musicians. Paul Inwood was there. He was one of the speakers. I knew seven of the participants from my work with Universal Laos, an international music organization.
Yeah, it was quite a gathering.
It was really
a who's who in music.
Exactly, it was.
It was wonderful. And you know, as somebody who's been a diocesan director now in three dioceses around the country, part of that educational piece is always frustrating because you put on this great workshop. And then the musician says, you know, I love this. I learned so much, but I'm going to go back. And my priest, you know, he won't let me do this. Right. He won't tell me to do this. So that education of the clergy is so important. When we come back, we're going to talk about two great educators who have really set the bar very, very high for pastoral musicians. And when you come back, we'll find out who they are. This is another cut from Paul Solomonovich.
Holy God, we praise thy name, but the great Latin hymn, Te Deum, in English.
Exactly.
This is how English and Latin can go together as you listen to this.
Here it comes. We'll be right back. Back with Father Virgil Funk and Music from the Tower. In our final segment today, we've been talking about everything under the sun here. We've been talking about Father Funk as the creator of the National Association of Pastoral Musicians. We've been talking about just what that meant to the musicians of the country and the clergy. We talked about the Musica Sacra Conference that we both just attended in Rome and what the Pope had to say. But NPM did a lot for surfacing for those of us musicians around the country, big name stars. And one of those big name stars came right from Southern California. Paul Solomonovich was a name that many of us outside of Southern California just didn't know. And it was really the association who introduced him to people all over the country. I brought Paul to several cities that I served as a guest conductor only because I met him at the NPM. Tell us a little bit about Paul and how you came to meet him. And
well, I met him at the ACDA, the American Choral Directors Association.
And he was well known in that.
He was very well known. And he was sought after at the American Choral Directors Association because of the incredible choral sound that he was able to create from with his master singers. But I was surprised, and I had a great discovery with Paul, because we brought him to do a four-day event running parallel with the association's convention, and a certain ordinary singers, I'm talking about the small parish choir members, and they're not trained voices, ordinary singers.
Probably some choir directors.
It was mainly untrained voices, and I cannot believe what Paul Solomonovich was able to do in 4 days in creating tone, blend, sound, unity, una voce singing. He had a gift for being able to draw the best from the simplest person and the person with a very simple voice.
At his command, he had the tools to really create that kind of sound. He knew not just to say, well, try it again, it's not good enough. He knew how to take it and really create it. Now, that's a genius move because, you know, people that work, Paul was a conductor of the LA Master Chorale. Well, those are all pros, you know, the best singers of the best. And from that group, he was able to make an astonishing sound. But what I found fascinating is he could take a group like that at the NPM convention, or for me in a diocese of all volunteer singers, and take a choir of 200 and turn them into the kind of choral sound that L.A. Master Chorale produced.
If you were listening to the recordings that have been presented in the previous three sections, they are a recording from the 1997 convention in Indianapolis, Indiana, of the National Association of Pastoral Musicians. Ordinary musicians put together for 3.5 days, and this was the final concert with these musicians singing in this single silent voice, knowing the dynamics of singing the line so that you heard the music move towards a point, and Paul could bring that out in a remarkable, remarkable way. And the musicians who learned that took that kind of skill training back to their own parishes. And so Paul was really significant in feeding the choir programs throughout the United States.
He was one of the great teachers. You know, I was fortunate enough to teach 2 summers with him here in Los Angeles at the Mount, St. Mary the Mount College. And but everything he did, Paul was an old school musician, you know, far before the Vatican Council. So he was really, everything he did, he based on chant. You know, when he could get you to sing chant perfectly, a whole group of 100 people, 200 people singing perfectly unison chant, he took that and exploded it into choral music of 4 parts and 8 parts, and every line still perfectly in unison. That uniformity of the vowel, the color, you know, he knew how to do that. He had the skills to turn that into.
Paul Solomonovich was hesitant to participate in NPM initially, because the association had, from its name, pastoral musicians. It sounds like it was a hum and strum organization where the only people that were there were singing the most progressive contemporary
folk music.
ensemble type music, where in fact we were singing the whole range of the repertoire as the Holy Father had instructed us.
Well, and it's people like Paul who brought that range of repertoire. I remember seeing him work with that same group in Indianapolis, the Sicu Cervo a Palestrina.
Exactly.
You know, and seeing him work that piece with those people, probably 99% of those people had never heard it.
Yeah. And that's the point, John, that it was not only musicians, high-quality, high-skilled musicians like Paul Solomonovich, but also people like Leo Nestor, who was at the cathedral, the Basilica at the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., but yourself. I mean, you were the president, the chairman of the board of this organization. So you know about this organization and committed your own ministry to serving the other musicians, and you continue to do it here at Christ Cathedral, bringing in all kinds of musicians singing in all kinds of languages and all kinds of styles.
Doing crazy radio shows.
And doing crazy radio shows. The other person, I mean, we could mention Frank Brownstead, who's retired, who was certainly in this
area.
At the
L.A. Cathedral, but what he did for L.A. and these giant conglomerate things, I got a chance to teach with Frank a couple of times at different colleges and universities. But NPM surfaced all sorts of people, you know, who really became the leading stars of liturgical music, everything from Michael Jonkis and David Haas and folk musicians and great ensemble musicians to the Leo Nestors and the Paul Solomonoviches and, you know, Father Larry Hyman.
I want to mention Larry because Father Hyman was a priest in Rensselaer, Indiana, who had a chant program. Now, Father Hyman, he's deceased, as Paul Solomonovich is also deceased. So we can talk about them in a legendary way. Exactly. Larry was committed to the study of chant before the Second Vatican Council and had dedicated his whole life to finding every nuance about chant. lo and behold, the Second Vatican Council comes along and they say, let's sing in English. A lot of people across the United States who were trained that way resisted and said, no, I'm not going to follow the church. Larry Hyman was one who went in the other direction. He maintained his chant richness and developed a program, the Rensselaer program at St. Joseph in church music, and he formed a whole another group of church musicians. Unfortunately, John, that program has now gone out of business in at Rensselaer this year due to money. And one of the things that I want to talk to our audience about is the importance of education for church musicians and the willingness of our audience to find ways to finance the education of the musician, whether at their own parish level, to go to the parish board and say, we need to find a way to send our musician to educational programs, because it will rebound back to the parish in terms of quality music, in terms of formation of the musician, not only in music, but equally important in their spirituality and understanding the liturgy and what it means and how to take that understanding and put it into practice.
Even just the spiritual formation of our liturgical musicians. You know, often we're the ones ministering to everybody, but who's ministering to us? You know, where is that piece going?
So my hope is that with a radio program broadcasting like this, we're reaching not only the musicians as our audience, John, but I hope you're also reaching the ordinary parish person who's devoted to the liturgy and the life of the church, and recognize that not only do the musicians who are trained have a responsibility for developing church music, so too does every member of the church. So it's something that is a responsibility, a call. And how do they do it? Well, one of the ways is by participating in the musical programs of their local parish.
That's right. So maybe that's being a member of a choir, or maybe that's by supporting a concert series or just supporting their musicians. We talked in previous shows about organ scholars looking in the children's choir to find that next generation of church musician, of church organist. All of those things are important pieces. It's getting those gifts honed and then passing them on.
And music is a risk. It's a risk-taking when you choose to sing. And a lot of people sit in the church and say, I'm not going to take the risk. I'm not going to risk hearing my voice, which is something less than perfect. And as all the great theologians say, who gave you that voice? God. So use your voice for the sake of praising and worshiping our great and wonderful God. Listen now to this piece.
And you've heard it right here at Music from the Tower. We are so grateful to you, Father Funk, for being with us today. Thank you so much for your insights, for your willingness to serve the musical community. And until next time, I invite you to go out and listen to a live performance of some great music. This is John Romero, your host, and Music from the Tower, right here from Christ Cathedral. See you next time.